You were just listening to A Birthday Bagatelle by Andrew Rudin, who is my guest until 11 a.m. That piece is, of course, an appropriate opener because we are celebrating the 75th birthday today of Andrew Rudin, who was born on April 10th, 1939. You heard piano duo Venti Dita in that performance. American composer Andrew Rudin studied at the University of Texas at Austin and at the University of Pennsylvania. His Il Giuoco, dating from 1966, was the first large-scale, serious work created on the Moog synthesizer. Andrew Rudin was on the faculty of the Philadelphia Musical Academy for 37 years, as it eventually became a part of the University of the Arts. He has composed works for ballet and modern dance, as well as music for the stage. Many of these selections were from the 1970s. He later wrote and continues to write pieces for orchestra as well as for chamber groups. Well, we could go on and on about Andrew Rudin's accomplishments, but instead, let's say hello. Welcome, Andrew. Great to have you here.
Well, and highly appropriate that you began with my birthday bagatelle, which tries to turn back the clock by playing the tune backwards first.
Yeah.
So most people don't realize what they're hearing until I slowly give it away. First, we have it in retrogression, then we have it in inversion, and then finally the tune in its usual way pokes out its head, answered by the inversion. And then after that, I think I put the retrograde and the forward version together, and then one more variation. So there's five different ways of
and you
13
know,
ways of looking at a blackbird? Well, this
well,
is
you know,
five ways of looking at happy birthday.
Well, you know, what's interesting, and we've talked about this and you've pointed it out, is that in retrograde, it's pretty good by itself.
I know,
that.
It sounds just as good it's backwards. I'm trying to learn how to also sing the syllables backwards now so I can truly
for
amaze
voice.
My friend.
Yeah, well, you could make a vocal version.
Well, it's it's if you go backwards, yeah. It's it should go, you day to birth. I have to have the words in front of me.
Especially behind the mic, that makes it that adds a little extra challenge. But Andrew, you know what? It's about. I think this is your fourth time here, I believe, and it is indeed a pleasure to have you once again.
Well, it's always you're always very generous to the many composers that come within your orbit here, and there are very few who don't either by disc or if we're anywhere in the vicinity. You've always been very generous. I know you just played Crumb, and I believe that a couple of years ago you had Crumb here himself.
I did
For an interview.
I think it's funny you mention that, and we'll be talking about Crumb and the conductor of orchestra, Andrew. James Freeman, because they were both here together,
right?
And our first major work, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes, was dedicated to both of them. So
yes,
it's very appropriate.
And I've known George ever since I was at the University of Pennsylvania. I was just finishing my master's degree there when he came on the faculty. I didn't study with him, but I got to know him during the 1 year where we overlapped
sure,
there.
Sure, sure.
And then since I've been in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area most of my life. And that and George has been there at the University of Pennsylvania, so invariably our paths kept crossing, and I had him many times as a guest at our school to talk to our students. And now the great pleasure is that since I'm working on the board of directors at the Orchestra 2001, they have given the premieres of all seven volumes of the incredible series, The American Songbook. And so it's been such a pleasure for me to be able to go and sit at the rehearsals. And he always invites me to come and follow the score with him. And I've been at the recording sessions. And I've gotten to renew my friendship with him considerably.
Well, you know,
a more generous person. He's probably the least pretentious world famous composer you could ever meet.
Well, I'm going to tell you a funny story. When he was here back in 2009, and I'll never forget this. He came and Beata came. She brought nice food. She brought a feast when they were here. It was a lot of fun. But I'll never forget. I asked him, "What do you want me to call you?" you know, whether you want to meet. Some composers have certain feelings, because
Maestro would do.
Yeah, right, right. But
no, he's not of that.
But he answered me a moment after he answered me, just call me George. He answered, you were very nice and asked me what I wanted you to call me. Mm-hmm. What would you like me to call you on the air? He was very, very, like you say, so down to earth.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's a wonderful person, and we're so privileged to be able to continue to work with him at Orchestra 2001.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful experience. But now, Andrew, we want to go to you.
Okay.
And I'm sure that's okay. Let's go.
Yeah,
briefly.
Just call me Maestro.
Okay, Maestro Rudin. Maestro Rudin. Right. It's great to have you here, Maestro. Let's go briefly to your early interest in music, which you owe a great deal to your very first piano teacher, Lila Crow.
Yeah, what are the odds?
Tell us about how that began and about what she did for you.
It's sort of amazing because I grew up in a very small town, Texas, a town called New Gulf, which was a company town. Nobody lived there except people who worked for the Texas Gulf Sulfur Company. Back in the early 1930s, or might have even been the late 1920s, they discovered that the largest deposit of sulfur ever discovered anywhere in the world is something called the Bowling Dome, which is in Wharton County, Texas. And this is, about 40 miles sort of southwest of Houston. And not too far from the Gulf of Mexico and Matagorda Bay and all that stuff. I grew up in this little town there. I don't know where my inclination toward music came from because my parents were not involved in any way musically. They sometimes liked to listen to classical music on the radio. Remember, there was no television then. Everybody sat around the radio and listened, and they liked certain programs that played. And there were programs then, the Voice of Firestone and things like that. Those were programs they liked. Mm-hmm. So I first heard classical music there, but I can't remember a time that I wasn't preoccupied with it.
Yeah.
And I think from about age 5 or so, I began to pester my parents about taking piano lessons. Well, we didn't own a piano, and my parents were reluctant to make an investment of that sort when they thought, well, he's a kid. Well, he doesn't
what is
know
he going to do
want.
With it? What is
yeah,
he going to do?
We'll get the piano, and he'll tinker with it for 2 weeks, and then
it'll be just sitting.
Yeah. So they asked people what they should do, and they got some wise counsel that said, well, why don't you wait until he's had a year of school and he can read and write a bit, and then you'll find out if he's really serious after that. Now, mind you, there was only one woman in this little town who taught piano. What are the odds that I would have wound up with someone who was trained in a conservatory in St. Louis had wound up living in this town with her grown children after her husband had been killed in the famous flood that almost obliterated Galveston. But she was extremely knowledgeable. I look back on it now and realize that she was probably as happy to stumble upon me as I was lucky to stumble upon her.
And that's true, and that's probably
because she got to introduce me to all the stuff that she loved, and I just ate it up. You know, I actually started my music lessons without my parents' permission. I was so they had told me back around Thanksgiving that year. I was in the second grade, and they told me, "Well, maybe after New Year's you can start." Mm-hmm. Well, to a 7-year-old, the distance between pre-Thanksgiving and early January.
Lifetime.
I just couldn't bear it. But I thought, well, at least there's a light at the end of the tunnel there. And I was walking home from school one day with a little girl who took the same route that I did coming home. But she didn't. She didn't turn off where she usually did. I said, aren't you going home? No, I'm going to my piano lesson, she said. So I said, can I come?
Yeah.
So I went, and the teacher said, Yeah, okay. Don't touch anything and be quiet and don't interfere. But as long you can stay if you sit there quietly. Well, she didn't have to tell me because I was completely fascinated with what they were doing. And at the end of which, I got up, shameless little liar that I was and said, my parents want me to take piano because I'm sick a lot and I need something to do when I'm home. And
shame you know, went against your parents.
I thought I needed a justification. That's in those days I sometimes had asthma. And so she said, do you have a piano? No, but they're going to get me one. And my friends, Dean and Nola, they live next door, and they'll let me play on their piano. And well, okay, she said, and you can come here and practice your lessons at certain times, you know, after school. So I did that, and I think 2 or 3 weeks went by. And then something my 7-year-old mind had not conceived of, she presented me with a bill and said, take this to your mother. So I was on the horns of the dilemma for a week, trying to decide, dare I go back to the teacher without the money, or dare I tell my parents what I've done? You know, so I finally wanted so badly to go back to the lesson that I confessed to my parents, both of whom broke out laughing and went to Houston and bought me a piano. But I'm greatly indebted. You know, everybody has some place in their life, a person who might seem insignificant in the larger world.
But look back.
But had I not had the good fortune to encounter Lila Crowe, a whole world would not have been open to me. She took me to Houston to see the Metropolitan Opera when they came on tour. She taught me not only Chopin and Bach and Mozart, but incidentally, Debussy was too far out for her. She regarded Debussy as impossibly modern and incomprehensible, except for Clair de Lune.
Now let's go. I want to go to a couple. You know, we're talking for a moment about your early things. Briefly, who were some of the contemporary composers you found interesting when you were young, when you started getting into things a little bit
more? Well, oddly enough, you and I will have an odd connection here. The Texas Gulf Sulphur Company, among other things, was the principal sponsor on the radio of the Houston Symphony in those days. This was in the days before Stokowski. I think Ephraim Kurtz, I believe, might have been the conductor. And I used to hear the radio, over the radio, the broadcasts, and the first modern piece that I remember catching my ear was Hovhaniss's Mysterious Mountain.
You know, Andrew, it's funny. Will that be it? And it's funny, thinking about the connection to today's show.
Yeah,
I played Hovhaniss a little earlier.
Really? Well, wouldn't you just, because I know the role he figures in your life.
Yeah, of course, that's kind of like similar.
But I still remember how fascinated I was with the exotic little flourishes of the celesta that haunt the piece. It still is a beautiful piece. That I remember. And then in our public library, after we moved to Beaumont, I have had no opportunity really to encounter contemporary music until I was till we moved to a larger town. I was not even aware that there was a world beyond Debussy. Manuel de Falla. I played the famous Ritual Fire Dance.
So
I guess that's steers a little bit into that. But once we got to Beaumont, I found recordings in our public library there of Copland and Barber. That was my, I think, I remember being totally smitten with Barber's Overture to School for Scandal and Music for a Scene from Shelley.
Well, those are great pieces, regardless, even now.
And I loved the Copland pieces that we came across. And learning to play the cello there in junior high school. By the time I got to high school, I was good enough to audition and get to play in the local symphony. Mm-hmm. And there we played the Adagio for Strings. We played Copland's Quiet City. Mm-hmm. So by the time, my original ambition as a composer, I wanted to be a Broadway composer. And both in junior high school and high school, together with friends, I collaborated and wrote two musicals, one of which was rather amusingly called One Way Ticket to Broadway.
Well, Andrew, let's go on, because you know what? I want people to hear your music.
Sure.
as much as possible today.
Well, that speaks for me and more than my story.
No, well, the stories are good, too, though. I'm not – the stories okay. are great. Actually, that connection with Hovhannes is very interesting. I didn't know Didn't know that. But anyway, since we are celebrating, let us go to your composition for two pianos and percussion titled – Celebrations, appropriate. It was written in 2009, and in it you are celebrating basically two people we've already talked about, George Crumb and James Freeman.
That's right.
Share with us a little bit about this work. This is a wonderful work, and we're going to hear the whole thing. Tell us just a couple of words
about it. Well, a curious thing is that I had heard a performance that was given by James Freeman and Marc Antonio Baroni of Messiaen's monumental visions of the Amen. This was a special concert, and I was very taken with that, with the two-piano writing in
that's
that.
That's another connection with me. Messiaen was probably the composer that got me into a lot of this eclectic music.
Yes.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Orchestra 2001 has its home in Lang Hall on the campus of Swarthmore College, and that hall was inaugurated with the commissioning of a piece from George Crumb, the now famous Music for a Summer Evening, for two pianos and two percussion. Crumb always acknowledges that Bartok is a major influence on his life in that particular piece.
Yeah.
And I knew that I had a fellowship at Yaddo. I was going away there, and I thought, well, I'll write this piece. I knew that I had a performance coming up at Orchestra 2001 of my viola concerto. Mm-hmm. And so I went away to Yaddo thinking that I would write this piece, hoping actually to interest the other major new music ensemble in town, their Network for New Music. Mm-hmm. I'm good friends with the percussionist Anthony Orlando of the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Sure.
He was a student in at our school, and I've known him all my life. I wanted to write this piece. I thought, well, I'll make my piece even a little more practical than Bartok's. I'll write it for two pianos and one percussionist. And I thought that in writing this, I thought, well, I know James Freeman's 70th birthday is coming up, and I know that Crumb's 80th birthday is coming up, so I'll dedicate a movement to each of them. Sometimes people are puzzled by the title Celebrations because the Crumb movement, it somewhat pays homage to his own style.
Style, sure.
And the first movement dedicated to George is rather somber. But celebration, if you look it up in the dictionary, one can celebrate a solemn rite as well. Celebration doesn't always mean throwing confetti and popping balloons, you know. But that's the second movement, which is much more jubilant.
Yeah, sure.
And the sort of interesting structural thing here is that both pieces are through composed without recapitulations, but the two pieces mirror each other in terms of structure. Both begin, the first piece begins with canons, the second piece ends with canons. Both of them reach a midpoint climax, have a quiet interlude, and then have a faster concluding section. So anyway, I think I was rather startled when I let Jim Freeman know that I had written this piece because he was talking about, well, you know, my 70th birthday is coming up, and I'm wondering if we might in some way even just use that as a fundraising device or a hook to hang some I sat there silently thinking, oh, I was going to spring this on him as a birthday surprise, and now they're talking. What do I do? Should I let him know I've written the piece or not? And I said, finally, he immediately said, oh, well, let's do it, you know.
Right.
They immediately scheduled that, and it was on a program, Crumb's what does he call it? It's just for voice and piano. It's a little Garcia Lorca songbook, a beautiful little piece. So I was very privileged to be the other half of the first part of that program, and then followed a series of pieces, all of which had been written specifically for the occasion and dedicated to Jim Freeman on his 70th birthday. So this was a whole celebratory thing here.
I think this is a wonderful piece. I remember a wonderful live performance of it during that retrospective on your music. And we hear it now. This is Celebrations, dating from 2009, by my guest and birthday boy, Andrew Rudine. In our performance, our pianists are Marc Antonio Baroni and James Freeman, and our percussionist is Anthony Orlando. Music of Andrew Rudine. Music by my guest, Andrew Rudin. You were just listening to his celebrations for two pianos and percussion dating from 2009. In our performance, you heard pianists Marc Antonio Baroni and James Freeman, along with percussionist Anthony Orlando. And that's from a Centaur compact disc titled Celebrations, music by Andrew Rudin. Well, Celebrations is a very appropriate piece to play today because today we are celebrating the birthday of American composer Andrew Rudin, who is sitting about 2 feet away from me in the WPRB studio. Andrew, again, great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming. And, well, you know, since we just heard a piece titled Celebrations, let's talk a bit about how your music is being celebrated this year, your 75th. What's happened so far?
Well, most intriguingly, there have been already quite a few events this spring, and I have the final one coming up this Sunday. We'll talk about that a little later. I'll walk you through something. I had been urging Sam McGill and Beth Levin, who had given the premiere of my cello sonata, been urging them to contact Mark Peskanoff at the Barge Music, a wonderful concert venue at the on an actual barge moored at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. And I had been urging them to contact him and do a recital there. And when I saw that they were, in fact, doing that and were going to include my sonata, I sent an email to, a Facebook post to Peskanoff and said, "Oh, Mark, thank you so much. I'm delighted to see that they're doing this and that my music will be there." And I said, "And it's extra specially nice because coming in March, it's like an early birthday present." So about four or five days later, he calls me and he says, "I've asked Miranda Cookson and Steve Beck to come and play a sonata. Play a recital, including your violin sonata. I hope you don't mind. I put it on your birthday." So on my actual birthday, April 10th, I was there at the barge both in March, and then again on my birthday, which was a very special occasion.
Sure.
Many people came, and it was really wonderful. And Miranda and Steve, of course, are remarkable performers. Miranda, I know, was just here last night in Princeton playing in a concert. There's nothing too adventurous for this young woman as a violinist. I mean, she's just remarkable, and I'm very privileged that such great young players are playing my music. So prior to that, in February, the presentation organization or producing organization, Bowerbird, I guess they call themselves that because that's what Bowerbirds do. They collect odds and ends of things and put it in their nest. But they sponsored a whole evening of my very early electronic music. They're very interested in the sort of history of music as it passed through Philadelphia. And I didn't quite realize at the time I was doing it, but I've now become a part of that history. I was there at the very early days of the of electronic music. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, got into electronic music because I saw the very first synthesizer ever made, the very first Moog synthesizer ever made, which was bought by Alwyn Nikolai, who ran a dance company. He showed it to me. I talked to people at Penn. They built a studio there. So the rest is history, as they say. But that was very, very successful and attractive evening. And I'm negotiating now to take that same program next April, completing the other end of my birthday year, as it were, to take that same program to Moog Fest, which happens every a week-long festival of devoted to everyone who's interested in Moog synthesizers for whatever reason. So I'm hoping that program will materialize there next April. And so that will sort of mark bookends at either end of my I told everyone, well, you know, when you're 75, you get to claim the whole year. So that's what's happening. And you were, of course, involved. I did a program for the Steinway Society of South Jersey with some of my piano music. And you and Allison and Duel Ventidita came and played a couple of my
happy birthday.
So that was great fun. And I have one other thing coming up on Sunday. I'll be at Andrea Clearfield's famous salon in Philadelphia, and we'll talk a little bit after
we hear the next music. In fact, we're going to be hearing your a movement from your cello sonata. Now, Andrew, this is from a commercial recording, which is going to be shortly released, including a number of your string sonatas.
I don't have the actual release date yet, but it will be sometime in August. Again, coming out from Centaur Records. And I have now three string sonatas. I wrote first a sonata for violin and piano, which I played the piano for the first performance of that myself. Then I later wrote the viola sonata in memory of my teacher, George Rochberg, after he passed away. And then came the cello sonata, which has been one of my most successful pieces.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful work.
In fact, I'm very pleased with it.
In fact, I think I presented this before it was totally done on one of my marathons a year plus ago.
That's true.
A year and a half ago.
So I've been very, very pleased that a number of cellists have taken up this piece, but most particularly Sam McGill, who's a cellist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, has been an especially strong supporter. Incidentally, I have a concerto in the works for Sam, a cello concerto with chamber orchestra, and that's about two-thirds complete.
Well, we'll talk more about that later, because I want to hear some of the stuff you're doing now, like looking to the future. But let's just listen now to the one movement which will be performed this Sunday, Consolation.
Yes, each of the four movements, it forms a kind of dramatic structure. So it begins with a very short first movement called Proclamation, then a slightly longer second movement called Repartee, and then a still longer movement called Discourse, and there's a kind of conflict between the piano and the cello, who seem not to be able to get on the same page with each other. But finally, by sheer force of eloquence, the piano gives up its pointless arguments and agrees to work in tandem with the lyricism of the cello. So this is an idea that I was influenced formally by Ludoslavsky, who talked about end-directed form, the idea that the first movement should almost leave a sense of frustration moving you toward the final movement. So the largest movement here is the concluding and lyrical consolation movement.
And I'm thinking that even goes back to his concerto for orchestra, the way you're describing the movements and the lengths and all that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we listen to Consolation from the Sonata for Cello and Piano, dating from 2010 by Andrew Rudin. We hear cellist Samuel McGill along with pianist Beth Levin.
Thank you.
It's a very beautiful Consolation movement from Andrew Rudin, Sonata for Cello and Piano, dating from 2010. In our performance, you heard cellist Samuel McGill, along with Bess Levin at the piano, and this was from an upcoming Centaur compact disc devoted to three string sonatas by my guest, Andrew Rudin. Well, good morning. It is 9:56 on Wednesday, May 14th, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey. Community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries. I am your host, Marvin Rosen, and I'm with you every Wednesday morning from 5:30 until 11. Now, you can become a fan of Classical Discoveries on Facebook and can also follow me, Marvin Rosen, on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining me. Today we are presenting the music of Andrew Rudin, who is here in the studio. We are celebrating his 75th birthday. And I have to say, Andrew Rudin is a man, even though he's 75, he runs around and does so many things like he's about 30. So he's enjoying his life, and that is great, and he's writing some wonderful music. However, Andrew, let's go to your career as a whole. Are there any events in your career that you think about and say, wow, this was absolutely incredible, like one or two things in looking back?
Well, I would have to say that coming in contact with Robert Moog was one of those things. And the fact that...
That's true.
Well, as I say, I had... You look back on your life and it all looks strangely purposeful, although things you think, how could these things have fallen together the way they did? But a childhood friend of mine became a dancer in Alwyn Nikolai's company, and I was at the time a grad student at University of Pennsylvania, and I used to come over to New York and see the shows, and they would let me see the shows for free if I would serve as a program guy and usher and what have you. So I, after doing that for a couple of years, of course, I got to know people there in the company and got to know Nikolai himself, and I was greatly admiring of his whole multimedia approach to dance, theater design. And, you know, he made his own sound scores from musique concrète techniques. And so he had a sound technician James Seawright, whose wife was in the company, Mimi Girard, and Jim saw at an electronic show Robert Moog, who showed his prototype of what became the Moog synthesizer. And Jimmy came back and said, Nick, you should have this. So Nikolai bought the prototype, which he then showed to me after one of these matinee performances. I was immediately smitten because I knew at University of Pennsylvania they were in the process of trying to set up an electronic studio, but aside from tape recorders and a few other odds and ends, they weren't quite sure what needed to go in it. And at those days, nobody even called it the synthesizer. If someone said synthesizer, that meant the giant RCA synthesizer that Columbia and Princeton eventually came to share in that big old